Thanks for the kind invitation to talk today. I'm very pleased to be here, and I hope that we can have some discussion after the talk. So I'll get through it in maybe half an hour or 40 minutes or something like that, and then have some time for discussion. So as Mark said, I'm a linguist, and I'm interested in what's happened in linguistics in the last decade. Is that suddenly there's been this whole interest in what's called language documentation. And it's a twist on what linguistics used to be. It's a realisation that we have responsibilities to the people that we work with and that the recordings that we make should endure into the future. So what I'm going to talk to you about is the method that can be used and some of the tools and some of the processes that there are, and also the whole issue of archiving linguistic material. But I want to start with a speaker of a language telling us something, because that's where it starts and ends, really. So I'll just play you this. This wasn't elicited. This came out of spontaneous discussion with this old man who's since passed away. But I want to frame my discussion with this notion that it's not just linguists and researchers who are interested in this. The people that we work with are telling us this for a reason. Often the people that I work with are clearly addressing future generations through my recordings. So I think this is part of our responsibility. And what I want to also point out is that what I just did then was played you some text. I played you a recording linked to some text, and it has a reference here. The reason that I can retrieve that piece of information and play it to you is because in the course of my fieldwork, I've done things in a certain way that allow me then to retrieve the information. And I think we can now think much more about the type of fieldwork we do and the way that we do our fieldwork that allows us to create representations of the material that we record. And linguistics... Oh, that was a nice little point that I can skip over. Linguistics hasn't been very good at doing this, although if we go back a century, when phonographs were on the scene, there were ethnographers and linguists who saw the possibility of these technologies. So here we have Leon Azoulay talking about all of the possibilities of the phonograph, that we were stuck with trying to write things in IPA and all of these arcane transcription systems. We were liberated from that by the phonograph. Well, that was a lovely vision, but in fact, it wasn't realised. And Azoulay was wrong. Malinowski talked about the need to present all available linguistic evidence, and he talked also about the importance of a phonographic record. So here we are at the turn of the last century up to the 1930s, and even then, Edward Sapir talks about the need for... He talks about anxious respect for documentary evidence. But what happened to linguistics in the intervening period? Between then and now, we don't have a huge amount of documentary evidence, a documentary record for languages that all the linguists have been working on. And of course, one of the reasons is that we had the Chomskyan revolution in linguistics, which sort of bypassed the need for linguistic data. Okay, it was introspection was all you needed. But I think it's a real shame that we had this wonderful foundation of these iconic ethnographers and linguists, and yet the possibilities weren't taken up. Again, Malinowski saying, there's no reason why we should not use the apparatus of sound films for reproducing fully contextualized utterances. And this at a time when sound films, you needed to carry huge amounts of equipment and develop film. And nowadays it's so much easier. We have digital technology and these things can be done more easily. Yeah. So up we have the project for linguistics has been writing descriptive grammars. It hasn't been so concerned with the underlying data that obviously must be used to feed those grammars. So we have grammar writers over the last 50 or 60 years who can write grammars without actually referencing data and who don't say what the data is that their grammar is based on. So they're making high-level analytical statements about a language, but we have no way of verifying what they're saying. And the speakers of the languages have no real way of locating the recordings that those linguists made in the course of their research. So in a recent study on grammar writing, we finally get, in 2006, this statement that good linguistic descriptions provide the raw data for much research into the organisation of the human mind. Well, the descriptions don't really provide the raw data. The descriptions provide an analysis. So even in 2006, we have these statements, even though he talks about shifting back to the centrality of data, in this collection of writings and studies in language, there is no mention of how you actually construct a grammar embedded in a set of data. Now, in the analog days, it was possible to link data to, analysis to source data. And this is a page from a grammar by Geoffrey Heath. And in that, and this is done by somebody on a typewriter, he's linking between source data and statements that he's making. Okay, so it was possible if you were really careful, and you know, this was even pre-computers, so there was no database underneath this. This was him keeping track of relationships and then presenting it in this way, which is, you know, virtually unreadable. But nevertheless, it's a testament to the underlying desire to keep that link between data and analysis. Another example is a set of texts produced by Carl George von Brandenstein in Australia, which came with a 45 RPM record, and the texts have an explicit link to the disc. So you can play the record and you can read the text. And I'd be really pleased to hear about other examples, because there aren't too many of them. And this is all pre-computers. But then in the 1980s, computers started becoming useful tools for linguists. And this is an example of some really wonderful and far-sighted work that was done by J. Randolph Valentine, working with Ojibwe in Canada. And what he did with this thing that he called Rook was that he created a method for putting texts and audio together using HyperCard, which was some software that was available on Macintosh computers back then. It's a wonderful set of material. He provided it so that others could take out his language material and put their own into it, and so I did for OneMon, which is a West Australian language. And you can see you have interlinear text, and you can click on it and hear it. And it also has another wonderful function of linking the analysis back to a grammatical sketch. So if you click on those words, it takes you off and gives you a bit of a grammatical sketch and explains what they are. This was all done in the late 1980s, early 1990s. There was sound and there was text. But again, it wasn't taken up by linguistics in general. This is one linguist producing this stuff and a few other people really interested by it, but it didn't take off and wasn't available as a tool. So when I came to do my fieldwork in Vanuatu, so I do fieldwork in central Vanuatu, on the island of Ifate, I was puzzled, I suppose, that I didn't have a method for collecting all of my recordings and citing those recordings in my analysis and being able to actually work with the corpus. So I had to develop my own tool to do that. And in the end, I was able to write a grammar and produce a DVD so that all the examples in the grammar were playable. And again, this is novel. Language is dynamic. Linguists have had a long history of reducing the dynamism of language to something they can write on the page. And I think we're at a point now where we can recapture that dynamism by using media. So the question really is, and it's a question for the World Oral Literature Project too, how do you create a citable set of textual material linked to primary data in the course of your fieldwork? So the idea is that you should be able to create this during your fieldwork so that at the end of your fieldwork you have a wonderful, rich set of material that you can work with, and you don't have to keep going back to it and reworking it because you didn't do it properly the first time. So what we can do nowadays is use software to create time-aligned transcripts. So we use software like Transcriber, and there are some others listed there, and Lan Transcriber. What they do is you're presented with a waveform, so you play the audio file, and you're able to link each utterance as you transcribe it to the media. And the software assigns time codes, so you don't have to worry about that at all. At the end of your session, you've got your transcript, but underlying that, you have time codes associated with each chunk of your transcript. And you are then able to look for a word in here and play it. So Transcriber does this, Actually, when I was working on my, so in the mid-1990s, Transcriber wasn't available. There were other tools around. But to create a corpus of all of these tools, I had to write some software. So I wrote some software called Audiamus, which was written in HyperCard, and then later in some other software called Runtime Revolution. And I'll just, so what Audiamus lets me do is associate text and media. I'll just show it to you if I can get it running here. And it lets me, sorry about the screen resolution, but it lets me look at all of my media files. So these are cassettes because I was working with cassettes to begin with. So I can look at a cassette and click on a sentence. Okay, and this has got 25 hours of recordings. And because it's digital, the recordings can be, let's see, audio or video. So we're able to search our text and I can't show you because it's down here, but once you've got text which is linked to media, then you can do all sorts of operations on the text and always have that link back to the media. So if your transcriptions are faulty, and typically when we start working on a language our transcriptions aren't wonderful, before we used to be stuck with that transcription because the analog tape was sitting on our shelf and our transcript was on our desk and there wasn't much of a point of connection between them. Now we can keep going back to our original media. If we're doing an analysis and we discover something that doesn't fit in our analysis, in our transcripts, we can go back immediately and listen to the media and correct our transcripts. Whereas before what we did was we said, there are some anomalous examples in our data and we don't know, we can't account for them, or we just ignore them. So it allows us to be much more rigorous in our approach to our analysis. And it also allows others to verify our analysis because we can present the analysis and the data together. So Audiamus allows us to do all this, but I suppose the question for me is, why did I have to write my own software to do this when we have a whole field of linguistics out there and people aren't doing this? So there's a real problem there. I think what's happened in the last decade is that linguistics has moved around and there are now some very good tools to be able to do this kind of work. And also projects like WELP, which recognise the need for textual material to be available online. Is WELP the way you...
We're fine with that.
Right. So then the issue is, can we get researchers to use these methods so that what they produce will automatically feed into projects like the World Oral Literature Project, and we'll be able to have wonderful representations of many languages arising naturally out of fieldwork rather than having to be handcrafted for each language. So I think using these methods allows us to do this. So Audiamus takes, and you have to have a media file, and an audio file or a video file, as we saw. It has to be transcribed and linked using software like Transcriber Elan. And then you can have various outputs. You can export the text in whatever format you like. Because you've got text and time codes of media, you can export it as QuickTime. You want to make subtitles for a movie, for example. You can export it in that format. You can export it into Toolbox, which is the tool that linguists use for doing interlinear text analysis. XML, tab delimited text, basically whatever you want, because you're just doing manipulations of text. As long as those time codes are there, it maintains that relationship back to the primary data. So, working in Audiamus, you have a piece of text, you can clip the codes. So this is the name of the sound file, and the start time, and the end time. So the critical thing in all of this is that we're not segmenting all the media files into hundreds of little chunks. Every sentence that we saw there isn't a chunk of media, it's not a little MP3 file. You have a whole file and you're pointing at time references within that file. And the good thing about that is it's less labour intensive to begin with, but it also allows you to maintain the context of the utterance. So if I wanted to, I could just put in the time codes before this and hear the immediate preceding context of this. You can import, so Audiamus again, I'm just harping a bit on it, but there are various functions that once you have your text in this format, you can do things like import various formats and export various formats of text. So one of them could be the WALP required format. You could export it into that, and then it would just go online and you'd be able to play it. Toolbox, as I said, this is a format that linguists use, and you can see in red the media references. So for every utterance, you reference back to the primary media. And then you can do all your analysis and that primary reference is maintained. QuickTime subtitles. Again, we don't really need to know about this, but the thing is that the tools we're using allow us to have these outputs. So it's important to know that the tool you're using has some sort of longevity, that data going through your tool has some sort of longevity. So I think there are a lot of benefits to using RDRMS. You have local control of the material and you don't have to rely on the web. You can interact with your transcripts, as I said, and keep improving them. So all my transcripts now, the primary version is actually in RDRMS. And every time I work with it, I can see problems, I can correct them, which obviously creates some problems for version control, but we can talk about that later if you want. We can clip citation forms, we can import and export. Has a concordance function, so every word in that body of data, with those 130,000 words, is presented in a file, which I can't show you because of the screen resolution, but it allows you to see each word in context. And for every word, you just click on it, it'll take you back and play that word in context as well. And you can create playlists. So if you have a body of data which is organised, as we saw, by media, if you decide you want to get a list of all the songs in your data set, you can create a playlist of all the songs, or you can create a playlist of all the sentences that you need for a particular talk you're giving at a conference. So playlists allow you to rearrange the textual material, but again, it's always linked back to the primary media. The problem with RDRMS is that you have to import all of the data into the program. So ideally, we'd have a big set of data and we'd be able to address that directly, rather than having to import it in and out of tools and create a workflow. And it's built in proprietary software, which is a problem. So Runtime Revolution isn't free and open source. And that's a problem if anybody else wants to work on RDRMS. So as I said, it implies a workflow. And the workflow looks something like this. You start with a recording, which you have to name. Now that may sound trivial, but many people don't name their files properly. And they end up with files with all kinds of strange names, and they rename files, and they end up with a massive data management problem. So you name your file, you capture it if it's digital, or you digitize it to create a digital file, and you add some cataloging information, some descriptive metadata, and that's information like who the speaker is, when it was recorded, what language it is, very simple stuff. But again, without this, your files become unusable. And you put those together to create an archival digital file, and you put it into an archive. So before you start doing your analysis, you're archiving material, which is quite a different sort of notion of archiving than we're used to. In the past, academics typically have not archived material until they've retired, or even later, and then their executors have to deal with their collections. But now we're able to archive material before we start our analysis, and that means that our analysis is firmly based on something that exists somewhere that we can cite, and other people can follow that citation to the repository and get information. Verify the same information in the archive. So once it's archived, then you can do your transcription and you start adding the apparatus that informs the analysis. And your transcription can then be archived as well, and then you can put that all into a media corpus as we saw with RDRMS. You can create a concordance, you can navigate the texts, and then you can output them into something like Toolbox, which allows us to create interlinear text. And that then can also feed off into a dictionary of the language. Again, all the time we're maintaining these media links. So if we want to create a dictionary, we have media links. So we want example sentences in our dictionary. We can include playable example sentences because the corpus gives us that. And then all of that can be archived as well. So this is a sort of notional workflow for getting material through fieldwork and then into various outputs. So the archiving is central to this, and we need persistence of the material that we're recording. So the names that we create have to persist, because once we've cited them, other people can go looking for that, and if that's next year, or if it's us in 10 years, or if it's the speakers of the language looking at our material in 100 years' time, we want our reference to it to be the same all the way through. And persistence can only really be given by an institution or an archive. We can't give persistence to these things ourselves. And websites aren't persistent. So creating a website, which many people do and think that that's an archive, is not a good solution for the long term. It's fine for presenting information, but, and Walt is thinking about these things too, you need to have some way of providing persistence. So that's a question I was asking Walt, is how will you maintain persistence and license the use of text, which is something that has to be really carefully thought of. And then there are various ways of identifying items in collections, and I don't really want to get into the digital object identifiers or handles. These are all very good systems for having citation forms that can be resolved over time. So these are web links, but they're created in a form that will allow them to be resolved over time. So I want to give you a brief example of Paradisic, which is an archiving project that I've been working with for a while. Paradisic is a collaborative project in Australia which has, over the last 6 or 7 years, digitised a lot of legacy recordings. So a lot of recordings that were left by researchers as analogue tapes. And a group of researchers in Australia got together and saw that these tapes were at risk and created the infrastructure which I'll describe now. At the moment, we've got about 2,600 hours of audio data that we've digitised. But we realise once you start digitising things, that's not enough. You have to provide a good catalogue and you have to make that material available somehow. So we wrote a catalogue. Initially, we wrote the catalogue in FileMaker Pro, which was very easy because I could use it. And then we shifted it to this online SQL PHP system. Having put the catalogue online and invited people to use it, we discovered that many linguists had never catalogued their collections, and that this was actually the first time they were cataloguing their collections was when they were depositing it in the archive. They were having to go back to field notes or head notes. They were going to have, and without them being alive, the head notes, of course, are lost. The head notes are those notes which are only known by the researcher. So it was at that point that we realised that actually this infrastructure is a critical research tool. It's a critical part of research, that you cannot have these collections lying around in various places without descriptions. For the sake of other people who want to work on this material, but also mainly from our perspective, for the speakers of languages that are recorded, because they are the ones who are coming to look for this material much more than researchers are. People are worried about putting material into archives because they think somebody's going to come and steal their research. And in fact, in general, no one's interested in other people's recordings because they're difficult to use, they're contextualised in a way that, you know, other researchers can't deal with them. But it's the speakers of language who really love this material because it represents their families, their ancestors, stories about their local society. So I think it's a critical part of our responsibility as researchers to create findable resources in these languages. So one of the ways we've done that also is to provide a geographic interface so you can locate things not necessarily by the language name or whatever, but use geographic points of reference. And having put it into our catalogue, we then subscribe to a bigger aggregating service called the Open Language Archives Community, which is a part of the Open Archives Initiative. Now, these are international initiatives for aggregating information from collections like ours. So this is a view of a piece of data from our catalogue, but it's from OLAC, and OLAC is the Open Language Archives Community. So what we do is we tell OLAC that we have a catalogue. It has information in it about languages. They go and harvest that every 8 hours, and they produce it in this form. It's a much better search mechanism than Google for finding information about language material. And the nice thing that happens once you put your information into this format is that OLAC also aggregates at a higher level. And what they then can do is put all the information on a particular language together. So then for every language in the world, OLAC has one of these pages, and it tells you what is available in all of the OLAC archives. So by putting material into a standardised format, it can be searched and aggregated in this way. So it makes it much more findable. So from a catalog, you can also resolve to the item itself if you have a password. So there's password mediation to the level of the collection, which is stored at the National Computer Infrastructure in Canberra in Australia. And with the appropriate rights, you can resolve to the level of the item itself. And you can see you have MP3 and WAVE versions of the data in there. What we also store is, in this case, visual images of the transcript. So the transcript was originally done by somebody handwriting a transcript into a notebook. So we took images of that and put that into the collection as well. So now in the collection you have a snippet of cataloging information, you have transcripts by hand, and here you actually have the transcript as a timeline document as well. So all of that's stored together in the collection. So having all that together allows you to reuse this material, and reuse is a really critical function, a notion, reuse of research materials. So to be able to reuse material, you have to first have done this transcription, and the transcription, as I said, gives you this reference. That's the first part of the reuse. We put it into a tool for doing interlinear text, so this allows us to put in word-by-word translations and then a free translation. So we're building on this foundation, but all the time that reference back to the primary media is there. That then lets us do things like create a dictionary in which a reference is made to a particular file. So here, that's our WAVE. Let's see, I think I can play that sound too if I get back. So that.
Maxell.
Okay, so if you want to be able to play words in dictionary, it's a very good idea to be able to do that, because dictionaries, that's one of the functions of dictionaries, people want to be able to hear words in the language. But to have done that, you have to have a reference to the point in the media file that that sound occurs. So I got a speaker to read the word three times in that sort of way. Very boring task for the poor speaker, but it was very valuable, and that then becomes available in this form. So the original transcription then goes through, does this time aligning, as we said, linking the word to a portion of the media file. But all of that has to be done before you can get to that point of having a clickable sound in a dictionary. And again, you can trace that a piece of text. You can have example sentences. And using the same process, you can output to a book. So this is reuse of the material. It doesn't. You're not just aiming for a dictionary that can go online. You're not just aiming for a text. But these are all products that can come from the same underlying data. And it's really, I think, a critical part of our practices, not just linguists, but as humanities researchers in general, that we understand the nature of the data that we work with so that we can create multiple outputs from it. So, to go back to our friend, we can only retrieve this quote because of all of that work that's gone on before. We can give this material back to people in forms like an iTunes installation, because all of the recordings that I made were created in this way, and I can index bits of them. I can say this bit of this recording is a story told by this old man. I can excerpt that and put it into iTunes and put that into an iTunes installation in the village. And then anybody in the village who wants to create a CD of their favourite ancestor, their favourite grandfather telling a story, can go in and use iTunes. I don't have to support iTunes, that's commonly available software. But because the data is created properly, it can be put into iTunes in the village. And I don't have to keep making CDs every time I go back to the village to give people, they can do it themselves. I think I'll skip this next little bit. One of the ways that I think we can present text, and this is relevant to the project, is as interlinear text online. And there's a very good example of this which has been produced by Lacito in Paris, and mainly the work of Michelle Jacobson, to get interlinear text and media available online. And if you're interested, there's quite a collection of material available here. And this has been a real wonderful model for how we can present media and text to people online. Another model that's used by the Archive of the Indigenous Languages of Latin America is to provide an MP3 file and a PDF. So you get a PDF document, just text, so there's no time alignment, it's just a story and a media file, and you can read the story and listen to the file. The other thing that you can do is use something like YouTube or Indigitube and put stories up in that way. So obviously there's a lot of ways that you can use the web now to present information, but I don't think YouTube is that useful for the sorts of things we're talking about, because we can't do text and media linking in YouTube. YouTube has no commitment to longevity, so it's fine as a representation of information, but it's not going to. We have no guarantee that it'll be there in 10 years' time. And there's no pathway into YouTube from linguistic fieldwork, and I think we're trying to create a pathway so that linguistic fieldwork will end up in things like the World Oral Literature Project. And there's no control over the IP issues, and I think that's a critical part of what we're doing, is we should be respecting the intellectual property issues that are inherent as well, and know what different items that we're producing can be used for, so licensing the use of the material. So we've been working on presentation of interlinear text online, and we've used, as I said, we modelled it on the work of Michelle Jacobson, but we've added the feature that people can upload their own material into this. So this is called EOPUS, the Ethnographic Online Presentation and Annotation System, because everybody has to have an acronym of some kind. And it allows us to upload text and media, which is created in the way that I've been showing you already. And you can have interlinear text, so it includes interlinear information here. And you can click on the speaker. Okay, and having done that, then the text and media are associated. You can click on this sentence and have that spoken to you. I don't know if I want to get too technical, actually. I think maybe I'll skip some of this. But I think the issue is that we need a standard way of presenting interlinear gloss text, and I'm hoping that working with Walp and some other people around the world who are working on this, that we can create these schemas, but I don't think I'll get into this right now. As I said, this allows us to upload, so the researcher can upload their own material, then browse by language or however they want to do that, and then view and concordance the material. So I'll just skip that. Basically what we have is a bunch of different forms of material, like we have video or audio, we have transcripts in various formats, which are then transformed into the right format by the tool that we're creating. There's a transcoding of the media to open media formats. I'll answer questions on this later. I don't think I'll go into too much detail here. But it allows you then to also transform your text into other formats like RTF and PDF as outputs. And that can all be served on the web through an authentication system. So that's a sort of rough schematic of the system that we're building at the moment. The exciting thing is that the web has really caught up, and we've got HTML5, which allows us now. It's a bit forbidding, but this is an HTML, a piece of HTML, and the exciting thing is that you can include this little piece of JavaScript, and you can see you've got a start time and an end time here, and that will play this text to you, just using ordinary and completely available tools. So Firefox plays this without having a plugin. So in the olden days, you always had to add in a plugin for QuickTime or something, Flash, whatever. This is now part of the new web and HTML5. So it's a very exciting development for presentation of media and text online. So there are a lot of projects around the place that are interested in these issues, and I hope that we can all work together so that we're all creating the wheel together and not the puncture. But what I hope we can do is that each little node, like Walp and Paradisic and Isla, for example, could have one of these servers serving these textual material that they have within their collections, and that's harvested at some point, and there would be a search mechanism which would allow you to find texts in any language. And that search mechanism could just be a Google map, which says, here's a Google map with instances of texts in languages from around the world. You can click on one of those and then have it actually speak some a text to you. So obviously a great installation for a language museum or something like that. So to do all this, we need to have standards, and have a, not just that we need to have standards, we need to have people using standards and agreeing on the standards to use for the construction of text and all these other things. I think we're getting towards that at the moment. And these all have to be built into a normal linguistic workflow. So we need to be training students now to be using these methods so that the material that they create can all feed into this as well. So we're not all just creating a whole lot of dead ends for recordings made during fieldwork. And this will allow us to create lots of different outputs, and it's very exciting. We can create lots of outputs from fieldwork to satisfy not only our funding bodies and our academic colleagues, but also the communities that we work with, so that we can return this information back to the communities we work with. In the end, I hope that'll allow us to perhaps catch the wind that Kalthabu Maile said was otherwise lost. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Nick, for that. It's a wonderful inversion of what so many people have yet to realise, that archiving can start at the beginning of your fieldwork and the products come out of that rigorous documentation. It's a very important lesson. There are some here in the audience who have been doing it under the radar of visibility for some years. But that's a very important point, and a very, I think, a crucial take-home point from this. The other issue, I think, is that of kind of collaboration, realising what's out there, making sure that your work, your data can be harvested, interoperable, and relate with those technologies and techniques of others. Could I start with one question, which is kind of to a more anthropological than linguistic audience, let's say. Linguists know of some of these tools, such as Elan, or Transcriber, and Toolbox, SIL, produce all kinds of tools that we can use to document linguistic data. But anthropologists, by and large, don't want to do interlinear text. They might not want that level of granular analysis. They might want something, a video file and a translation or a transcription, or perhaps just a kind of contextual story that sits around it. And they certainly want to have access permissions set. Mm. How do you think anthropologists or ethnographers could work with some of these tools without getting stuck and scared by the kind of complexity of linguistic annotation that would be robust, that could be harvested by something like EOPAS without providing a time aligned, well, maybe timeline, but not interlinear text.
Yeah. I think that's actually it's a really good illustration of the strength of this, is that you can have an anthropologist creating a description of some material that they've recorded, and then perhaps a linguist who's interested in that language using that material and providing a richer analysis. So that the and you know, this is all assisting us in much more collaborative fieldwork. So you can produce, if you have a video, for example, you may want to say that these 2 minutes are part of a certain ritual, and these 5 minutes are then part of, you know, gossip. You don't have to provide a word-by-word translation of that at all. Mm. Each of those things provides an index, which makes it more useful than a media file on its own, which is virtually useless.
Right.
So I would encourage you, you know, to do this kind of transcription. If you're doing a transcription anyway, I mean, if you've got field recordings and you're transcribing them in Microsoft Word or something like that, there is really no extra effort in doing a transcription that has some time codes built into it. But it allows you then to interact with your material much, much more easily than a Microsoft Word document would.
Perhaps I can ask one more question before I turn it over. But, you know that our colleagues in SOAS, at the Endangered Languages Project and Archive in particular, have built a catalogue now which can handle deposits where you as the depositor can set the level of access by deposit item. So you could say, that video let everybody see, no longer required, but that one only researches, that one only password of authentication based on email address. So it can be very highly tuned and very nuanced. Could, you know, the software that you're developing and some of the tools that you're seeing colleagues do also work with that you could listen, unlogged in to 20 minutes, but the last 5 minutes you have to authenticate for?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's part of the design that we have. So this is actually, what I've shown you is the first version, and we're working on the second version this year, which will include a stronger authentication and access module. But a lot of the texts that go into this basically should be open and freely available. If they're not open and freely available, then they shouldn't actually appear in this at all. They'd be in the deep archive, as we call it.
Right. Yeah. I'm sure there are questions.
Right, most academics wait until they retire to archive their material.
to say I think it's fantastic that you've been doing this. And I don't mean any disrespect, but people of your generation typically don't understand the issues, let alone actually do this kind of work. That's wonderful. And yeah, I think that's the only thing we can do with these databases, that people are creating wonderful databases in proprietary software that's completely out of date, you know, within 3 or 4 or 5 years. And we've all, I'm sure we've all had the experience of going back to something we created 10 years ago and not being able to open it. So you absolutely have to export that in some way and try and capture the relationships that we've all very cleverly made in these databases. But they have to be exported into some flat structure like, a structure which is text, but not necessarily flat. It's a hierarchical structure within XML. So, I think that's all we can do. But the problem is that a lot of these databases are now, you know, unusable, even now. So we have early versions of databases in all kinds of formats that we can't access anymore. So that's a real problem. But I think we've learned so much from that experience of not being able to open these, that we're now training students in ways that allow the data to live on after our use of it. Your first part of your question was about the lack of kudos for archiving. And that certainly has been the case. It's interesting now that the NSF, the National Science Foundation in America, will be mandating deposit of material as part of the condition of getting an NSF grant. Now, that doesn't mean that they're creating repositories, but you know, the fact that they're mandating it, I think, is important. Of course, that means that it's more work for the researcher. But I think we can build methods where the archiving side of it is not so onerous. If we can build this into the normal methods that researchers use, I think that's the critical understanding for researchers is, if you're a historian and you go to an archive and you discover wonderful material for your particular research project, how can you create records of that in a way that other people can use them so that that information can be archived? And I think it's training the researchers to firstly understand that that's an issue and then how they can actually do that without it adding a lot to their work. And I think that's critical because they won't do it if it adds a lot to their workload. And the other thing is, I think it's beholden on us now, us, we who are advocates of this, to change academia so that this is counted, and that a good archival collection, certainly of language material, should be counted as a publication. We have to figure out how to evaluate it, and maybe we can go through a peer review process and say this is an A1 collection of material, and that could count on your CV. And I think that may be one solution to it. I don't know if that answers your question.
I'm very sympathetic to this movement towards standardisation and open access and pooling resources. And I really do think this is the future for this sort of kind of documentation work. And I've just come out of finished a funded project where we're working on a Dalit group in the Middle East, a very diverse Dalit group, and I wanted to create some kind of electronic software. I didn't find anything really available which would do exactly what I wanted to do. I mean, I wanted to have some kind of very complex system of mapping, basically creating a sort of dialectal mapping system to retrieve data about 200 dialects.
Yep.
Now, I mean, there was also an audio text sort of side as well, which is not as unfortunately not sophisticated as this system. But I think the point I want to make is that now the funding is finished, I mean, maybe some continuation in the future, but I realise now I have this piece of technology created, but there is this fear I have, it's going to turn into a white elephant.
Mm.
It's not going to be, it's going to go out of date, or will be become incompatible with other systems at some point in the future, inevitably.
Yeah.
and so I certainly, you know, would welcome a sort of, you know, integration of projects like my own into a wider sort of standardized open access system. However, the only problem is that when I was working purely in my own sort of software, I could do exactly what I wanted for that specific project.
Yeah.
Particularly, you know, dialectal diversity is one of the issues.
Yeah.
And suppose, you know, the slight sort of deterrent about trying to simply take on board what's available is that perhaps it doesn't do exactly what you want it to do. So I think kind of the future will be if those two things can get closer.
Yeah.
If somehow, as plugged in, as it were, to a standard system, there was sort of a constant sort of network of people developing a system which is going to be maximally useful to a maximum number of people.
Yeah.
So we're keeping sort of a, and of course we need resources to sustain that.
Yeah, and I don't think, when I talk about standards, I'm really not talking about forcing our work into standards in the way that I hear you saying that you don't want to, you know, to make your work conform to a certain standard in a way that's deleterious to your own research progress. Right? You want the standards to assist you. But I think in your case that the issue is creating good underlying data and having some framework, which is the software, which allows you to represent it in certain ways, so geographic representation. But the data itself should be kept separate and should be able to move on. And as we heard, maybe having a way of exporting the relationships that you've established in the software in some form like XML. Maybe the higher level issue is that we actually have lots of similar needs, and I'm sure there are a lot of people who want to represent, and I know TimeMap and these other projects which map information over time, so you have geography and time, and this is all mapped in open source software. So there are tools around. It's a question of us also sharing information and finding out what may be suitable for what we're doing. Of course, the problem then is that we've got funding to do a certain project, and we don't really want to use something that somebody's already built, because then we can't do what we've got funding to do. So there are other sorts of considerations in there as well, I'm sure. Is like version control, I suppose. You have multiple versions of the same thing. So the model here is that you have an archival version of your material, and then you have derived versions. So EOPUS would be a derived version. You would have an archival file, and you could have, which is high resolution. So it's archiving standards for audio, 96 kilohertz, 24 bits. That's stored in the archive. But then I would create an OGG Fiora, which is an open source form of that file, to put into EOPAS. And so it would be in a separate location. So you have this archive where the stuff is stored permanently and has integrity. And then you have these derived versions, which are virtually disposable. Right? They're not primary considerations for data integrity. If you're working on a dictionary or you're working on an interlinearization and annotation of texts, then you may have different versions of that over time. And what I do with that is that I put different versions into the archive over time and date them. So there are, it's like having a version control system. But so you date this version of the dictionary, and then you put the next version of the dictionary in which supersedes it into the archive. And then again, you can have various versions that you put on the web, but none of those is necessarily the primary data.
And does it affect that part of space from a number of different
well, ideally what would happen is you'd have, an archive like Paradiso, which has lots of material in it, and you'd select some sample texts out of that and put them into the opus. So it's not automatically harvesting anything out of it. At the moment, that's not the vision. But ultimately what we'd like, I think, is to have a set of material that we work with in, say, a big XML, set of XML documents, and we perform operations on that and continually enrich that. But the data is always in one place. But we don't have that at the moment. So at the moment we have this workflow, and the problem with workflows is that when something goes from one through one process to the next, you may have left something behind, and we don't want that. I mean,
that may be changing.
Exactly, and that is, of course, that's a real problem, and we have to make students aware of that when we're training them, so that they know what they're losing, in a particular process. So ideally, yes, we'd have this wonderful pool of material and have tools that could operate on that tool, on that pool of material, enrich it, but not actually convert it. It would just be constantly being enriched. I think that's the image, but I don't know of any tools that do that at the moment. Do you?
Well, we're kind of working on a kind of system with multiple museums, where multiple collections are coming together, and whilst they're being centralised store, they're constantly being updated by institutions or themselves updating their own, changing their own record base. So that even though you've got a centralised store, it's totally up to date with what's being fed into it from around the world.
But that's a metadata catalogue.
It's basically a data collection.
I wouldn't recommend anybody use AIMS. It's really just a model, and I use it fine, and some of my students use it. It's not great on Unicode.
But I'm just also wondering, I mean, if it's not integrated now, if you have thoughts about how that might be possible to do, particularly at the side of turning materials to communities where they may not be familiar with Unicode.
Yeah. All the other tools that I've talked about use Unicode. Well, so transcriber, LAN, toolbox. You can create text in any script that is supported by Unicode. So it's not a problem. It's just because I wrote Adiamus and I don't have a need for very much Unicode in the language that I work on. That's another factor where it came from.
I think one interesting thing that's coming out is this sense the word archive increasingly means to people. This is of course a positive development, something that's public and open. But actually, archives can be personal ones that are your sort of working collection. So it's not that you by putting it in an archive, you make it accessible all the raw data to the whole world instantaneously. It could just be your personal archive on your own laptop, right? The question is how you then interact with that. But if your data is consistent at that level, then of course the multiple derivatives, be it dictionaries, books, web pages as derivatives rather than as sort of standalone products, which then at a certain point inlays.
Yeah.
So I think it's a very important lesson, definitely for us to think about as a project.
Yes, I have an ethnographic question which goes back a little bit to an earlier point that Mark made about access and authenticating who gets access to different levels of material. And just how does the work that you're doing on Fante fit into the Indigenous Field Workers program in Vanuatu, which some people here may know has been going for a couple of decades quite strongly with people making tapes and going out to villages and depositing them in the cultural. And in particular, to their notion of the taboo room where the cultural center, there is this place which does try to limit access to particular information that comes in.
That's their system, and this is my system, and we work together. I mean, I worked at the cultural center for a few years.
Yeah.
And
but what I mean is, like, is some of your data going back to them?
Yeah.
To what extent are they commenting on levels of access? And just how does it work on the ground?
Yeah. Well, the Tubba Room has a lot of publicity. And, you know, I know that the cultural center is very well regarded. But the Tubba Room, so taboo is taboo, like I think we know. It's a room in which material is held. And there's very little differential degree of access to the material in that room. It's just a room in which people should respect the material that's there. So if I put material into that room, I have no idea what conditions they will put on access to that material. They don't ask me. So it's not a well-formed system. We've taken tapes from the Tubba Room that they've asked us to digitise and then given them back digital versions, and we've digitised some of these other earlier recordings from Vanuatu and given them back as digital versions to them. And we actually also keep a hard disk of material that goes backwards and forwards between Vanuatu and Australia to back up some of their collections. So we have that sort of relationship with them. But the finer level of access to particular types of material hasn't been an issue with my recordings.
Any thoughts or theories about this?
Yes, Charlie, I'm talking. I think there's sort of small detailed question about the next alignment. Is that, I mean, I've done a lot of work on transcribing text, hundreds of hours.
Yeah.
And of course, I have to confess, I often don't
Yeah.
What's your attitude to such sort of adjustments that I've just been mentioning? Because such adjustments are important.
Yeah.
I think when you want to get a sort of usable transcription system for the linguistic analysis.
So this is an example of a cleaned up text. I mean, it's interlinearized. If we look at court hearing, which is a really bad, you can see in here, there are all kinds of problems because, well, let's listen to that. Okay, I'll stop there because it's hard to listen to, but this is a recording made in a very big room with one mic. It was a court hearing. There were people from all over the place talking. It's a wonderful performance, but it's very difficult to do anything with. If I were to interlinearize this, I could have two different lines, one which was the original recording and then one which was a cleaned up version. And you keep those together. So that for some people, they don't care about the authenticity and the faithfulness of the recording, of the transcription. And, you know, if you're producing a book of text or something like that, you may produce a cleaned up version and say, you say that this is a cleaned up version. But at in some location, the deep archive or somewhere, you have the faithful transcription. So that's the way that I would deal with it. Yeah, and this is a really problematic one. It's going to be very rich when I get to do something with it, but it's very difficult to work with.
What do you do when you've got people writing their text in these languages rather than dictating them?
Yeah.
Because you're into all sorts of new problems and opportunities as well.
Well, what we've done is put text, we take images of the text, so you can take a photo of the page. So that's one way, if you don't want to actually keyboard it. Is that...
Well, I'm just thinking in terms of what the status of this material is, but it isn't, well, perhaps this is more of a question for Mark, but it is no longer all literature.
Right.
Even though the text may actually be, I mean, I'm working with people who sometimes, I'm working with text, some of which are recorded and transcribed and translated, and others where people have written them in notebooks and things like this.
Mm.
And I'm treating them all the same for the purpose of the publication.
Mm. Yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean, maybe it's just good to note that this was a written text and this was a recorded text. Somewhere in your book, I don't know if you want to have an appendix which says which texts were recorded and which were written, because there are going to be different stylistic differences, and
yeah.
Some people may be interested in what those differences are.
Because a lot of these people are working, well, I hope they would be working towards a written literature in their languages.
Yeah.
Even though you'd hope that the difference in the written and spoken wouldn't be quite as severe in English, it's not even developing.
Yeah.
Certain ways.
So I have early texts, handwritten texts in the language that I work on from the 50s that turned up in a collection somewhere. And they're wonderful things. So what we did was we retyped them, because language had actually changed quite a lot since the 1950s to the 1990s. And we translated them into the current language and then presented them in a little book. But what we also did was took images of each page and put that into the archive as well. So that's, images of pages are quite useful because they're very quick and easy to do, as long as you've got a good description of what they are to put them into a collection.
So you're still concerned to preserve the original source, whatever that was?
I think so, especially if there's not much available in that language. I think it would be really important to do that. And I know that you're working in Solomon, so the Solomon Islands Museum isn't in any state to...
No, I used to give it a sense once upon a time, but I'm not sure how to do it.
Yeah.
I think one of the things we're seeing is happening with researchers who are starting out now, particularly in linguistics, but also in related fields, that materials that are born digital, if they're properly catalogued, to be like an archive, it's catalogued, can be spat out in different formats. So the book is just a derivative of data rather than the final end product. I mean, recte verso, a lined set of texts, cannot be interrogated if it's just printed. But of course, the database can be. And that's one of the directions that we're seeing a lot of research happening in now, is that the book is one product, but there will be an associated or enriched. enriched website or CD attached, and those things start to speak to each other rather than just be standalone divergent products.
Yeah, but these things are much easier to build if you build them from the start rather than getting to the point you're at now where you suddenly start having to somehow fit together many years of research into a product.
I think. Well, I'm working with written text and I have to sort of retrofit the sets to them.
Yeah.
And then, of course, having any of them so thoroughly in the process.
Yeah.
There's going to be some. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure.
It's much easier when we used to just write books.
Yeah. I won't get into that.
Well, that's a good one to end on. So, back to analog. Thank you very much, Nick, for.